This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This week, President Obama signed the 21st Century Cures Act into law. It authorizes $1 billion to prevent and treat opioid abuse across the nation. Here in North Carolina, drug overdoses are causing more deaths than ever before. Last year, more than 1,200 people died of drug overdose, which is five times more than in 2000. Many of these deaths are related to the misuse of opioids. What starts as the use of prescription pills often leads to heroin addiction. Louise Vincent lost her daughter, Selena, to a drug overdose this March. Louise is also a recovering addict and works with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, and she joins me now. Louise Vincent, welcome to the State of Things.
Hello.
I'd like to talk about Selena at some point, but first I want to hear your part of the story because you have struggled with addiction as well as mental illness for since your teen years. Tell us how it started for you.
Well, I grew up in a family that, I mean, most people would say this wasn't supposed to happen. You know, my parents were educated, professors. We went to church on Sunday. I had a good life. You know, there was no trauma, no abuse. And when I was about 13, things just dramatically shifted. And what we now know, it was bipolar disorder or mental illness. But people didn't know what to think of it at the time. And so, you know, people thought it was conduct disorder, misbehavior, poor parenting. So it was a rough time. And that went on for my entire life, you know. So I've been struggling since the time I was 13 on and off with substance use.
Well, how did that, can I ask you how that led to that disorder at a time where it may have been misdiagnosed or not diagnosed? How did that then lead to addiction for you?
Well, addiction or drug use, you know, people use drugs because it solves a problem. And for me, it solved a problem, and it's taken me a lot of years to sort of sort out what was happening. But I have a very critical sort of narrator of my life, you know, your conscious that speaks to you. And it's just a really nasty brain that says, oh, you shouldn't do that. Oh, you're worthless. You're no good. You know, and just a constant berating and just a ugly dialogue that when you don't know what's going on, it's self-defeating. You can't see through, you know, you can't see through problems. You think your problems are going to be there forever. And so substance use was sort of it quieted that voice. And of course, when you're being labeled as a problem with a child with a problem, if you don't feel like you can be good and if you don't feel like you can achieve, then one of the things that happens is you go to the other end. Well, if I can't be good, then I guess I'll be bad, and I guess I'll be really good at being bad.
Right, and that's what you're calling me anyway. I can't get out of that mess, so why don't I just at least medicate myself in the process and feel better about myself? Can I ask you how you started with this? What drugs did you start using?
At the time there was cocaine, and I used cocaine before I used marijuana, so. And just really anything I could find for a long time. So I was not a person that had a lot of, I didn't have any special choices for a long time. I very much wanted to escape the pain of my reality. And my reality was truly painful. And I believe if I hadn't found drugs that I would have killed myself. I could not cope with my reality at all. And so drugs solved that problem for a while until they created much greater problems.
Now, please tell us about Selena.
Well, Selena was born to both her father and me had mental illness, so she didn't have much of a chance. Unfortunately, she was biracial, and she was a sweet girl, and she grew up and had some learning disorders, and I had some learning differences as well. And so we worked with her. You know, my mother and I raised her because her father died when she was two. And it was a good situation to have my mother and myself. Most people don't know what mental illness really means and how that translates in the real world. And what it means, or what it meant for me, is that I have trouble with consistency. I have trouble, you know, keeping a schedule. I have trouble, you know, following through. And so living with my mother made that a lot easier. She was very good at consistency. And so between my mother and I, we were able to give Selena a good life. And we talked about the possibility of addiction, and we talked about how susceptible she was, and if we could have talked her out of addiction, we would have. I mean, we didn't leave anything unturned.
Were you in and out of drug use at this time, or where were you in terms of using drugs when you had your daughter and as you were raising her?
Well, and at different times, I had different issues. Throughout my life, I have struggled, and when I think people have a funny idea of what addiction looks like, I think sometimes they think that it is just one directional, that everything is really bad and then you stop using and then it gets good. And my life, it just looks all over the place. So when I've had traumatic life issues, then, and depression and my mental illness has been worse, then substance use has been a problem. And so I've had issues. At 28 is when things, I was about 28 when things were the worst. And that was when Selena was about 6 or 7. And I went away to a rehab for about a year. And then I returned. And I was able to, Selena was what I kept my mind on. I wanted so much to show her that she could make it in this world, and I worked very hard to I went back to school, I got a master's degree. I became passionate about life, and I believe that that's what creates and sustains change in people, not pain. I believe it's passion for living and involvement and being part of and being connected that allows us to make these huge changes in our life and to sustain them. I was run over by a car and injured, and that was a few years. That was about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and that was a very rough time for me. And so there was some period of time where depression and substance use became a real problem.
And you're making this supreme effort for yourself and your daughter, trying to sort of stop the narration that keeps drawing you down, making this supreme effort. And as you said, you came from a background where it wasn't expected that you would fall into abuse. But ultimately, Selena did start using drugs. Tell us when that happened.
Well, it was clear that Selena had emotional and some mental health issues way before substance use. And in fact, I feel very strongly that that was the majority. Chaotic substance use is mental illness. So she had a struggle with cutting herself, and she was very involved in relationships and feelings, and that's very much what I struggled with, is just being driven by enormous and huge feelings. And it was clear that this was going to be part of her life by 13 and 14, certainly by 15. And I believe that she had, all sorts of, she wanted to be connected, and she wanted to, she very much protected me and loved me. And it was clear that there was going to be a struggle.
When that struggle was clear and when you knew she was using drugs, how did you handle it? What did you do? What did you say to her?
Well, I very much tried to do different than what my parents had done for me. And I want to be clear that my parents did for me what they were told to do at the time. So, I grew up in the 80s, and, the wilderness camps and tough love and all of this were very much part of what we told people to do. We told parents that if they helped their children, they'd be killing them. So my parents did those things, and those things hurt me enormously. And I believe exacerbated my drug use and made things far worse. And so I had shared those things with my family and my mother. And so we tried to do everything in a way that presented love and understanding of what she was going through. None of the tough love, and that's very hard. I'll be honest. Harm reduction is a philosophy that I believe in and live by, but it is very hard to practice with the people that you love the most, because you want to force people to do what you want them to do.
Particularly when you see they're hurting themselves. So there's one, that's the kind of the power equation for you. You know, I'd like to win, and I certainly want to see you stop hurting yourself. You say you resisted that, and you instead turned to harm reduction. We'll talk more about that, but how did that look in your case? Because eventually you actually asked her, and not told her, but asked her to consider a rehab facility. Tell us what condition she was in, and a little bit about that moment and how it turned out.
Okay. Well, Selena, I raised Selena so that she could be honest with me. It was very important to me. I felt like in my life, I did not have people that I could tell the truth to about my substance use and about my trauma and about my pain. And so I raised Selena so she could be honest with me and talk to me about anything. And believe me, she talked to me about anything. And it was very hard on me. Sometimes I would have preferred she lied. But she came to me one evening with her boyfriend, and that she had injected drugs into an artery instead of a vein. That's what I think had happened. And so that causes swelling in your arm and a headache and it causes sort of a prickly feeling all over. And she was afraid that she was going to die. And so when she came in, I talked to her and her boyfriend, and it was obvious to me that they were injecting drugs. They told me they had reversed each other's overdoses, you know, because I raised her in harm reduction. So she was trained in overdose recognition and reversal and had naloxone and all of these things. So they just sort of poured on me everything that was going on. And I became fearful that I would not be able to protect her, that I could not, that this was beyond what I could oversee. And I couldn't, and I was having a huge struggle providing love, acceptance, and I was struggling trying to find the balance between loving her and killing, you know, and just and being cruel, because when you're so afraid for someone, it's very hard to be loving and non-judgmental and accepting and so it was a complicated process, and I am emotionally driven, and Selena was an emotional person, and so that can be really explosive, as you can well, I'm sure you can imagine. So I came to her and I said, Selena, I want you to sit down somewhere and just take a look at where your life is going. And I really believe that I was sort of taken in by the what treatment, American treatment, money can do for American treatment. I have never trusted the treatment industry. It has never provided me with anything that I felt. I think I've been hurt more and harmed more by it than helped. But I spent a long time on the phone with the treatment centers explaining that I did not want 12-step care, that I expected it to be real treatment, and that she was definitely had mental illness, and that I didn't want just a sham of a dual diagnosis rehab, that this needed to be real treatment for people with mental illness. And we spent hours on the phone.
But it's interesting, if I can, and forgive me for interrupting you, but it is interesting, this point that you made, that you asked her to examine her life and take a look at the trajectory. You didn't tell her. You said, look at your life and you tell me if this is where you want to go. And she made the decision. She made the decision to go into rehab herself. And that's when you then became very diligent in trying to pick which rehab, and you knew the things you wanted to avoid and spent hours and hours, as you say, trying to pick the right one. She did go into rehab, into a facility. Tell us then what happened next.
Well, I have to say this, that I picked the rehab that I picked partially because of money. She had insurance, and insurance would pay. And, you know, American treatment is very expensive. And so some of the treatment centers that I thought were better, you had to have $20,000 and $30,000 up front. And that was not the kind of money that I had. So we picked something where I said it'll be beautiful. You know, you can, they're not going to treat you bad. All of the things that I wanted out of treatment that I thought that if she had, that it would make a difference. And I said, you don't have to quit using. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. Just please sit down and make sure this is the way you want your life to go, because you know the pain that follows. You've watched my life. You know that once you're in the criminal justice system, I cannot get you out. You know that the trauma that's going to come is going to be pain I can't save you from. And so we chose a rehab, and she helped me choose it. And she went, and it became and it was not close to my home. And it became clear pretty quick that it wasn't what I thought it was, and that she wasn't receiving the kind of care that I felt like she needed. And at one point she even called, and she wasn't in the rehab, and she was over 18. And that made it really difficult, too, because she was 19. So she was just a little bit over the, I mean, and not long, I mean, a couple of months. And so she was able to take me off of the, you know, off of the list of people to be called, and do things when she wanted to prevent us from talking to the treatment center.
Which made it far more difficult when she did ultimately overdose at a facility that apparently didn't have the drug to counter the overdose. Tell us about that.
Right. And I didn't, you know, and that's my failure. I did not think to ask them. I just can't imagine anybody that deals with opioid-involved people should be trained. It should be required that they be trained in overdose recognition and reversal. And naloxone should be on site. I mean, right along with the fire. We can't keep believing that people don't use drugs in rehab and people don't use drugs in places they're not supposed to. We send them to rehab because they can't stop using. If we can't keep drugs out of prisons, then we certainly can't keep them out of rehabs. And treatment centers are just opposed to having these conversations about what happens when people relapse. It is as if to have that discussion means that they somehow acknowledge that it might happen. And in fact, it does happen in most cases, because they have a traditional treatment, 12-step based treatment, has about a 5% success rate, which is really sad.
Well, so tell us about this strategy then, Harm. You mentioned naloxone. That's a drug that can reverse the effects of a drug overdose. It's been controversial, though more and more police agencies and localities are accepting this now as a way of reducing the number of deaths caused by opioids. That's one part of the strategy of harm reduction. Tell us more about harm reduction, what it is.
Well, harm reduction is about love, and harm reduction is about being able to provide an intervention and services for people at any stage of the drug use continuum. So what that means is, for most people, when they go to drug treatment and they say, they couldn't say something like, I really need help, but I'm not ready to quit using. If you say something like that, then you're going to be told something like, well, you're not ready. Maybe you haven't had enough pain yet. Some of this kind of stuff. So there's this idea that you have to be well before you can be, before you can get help. So you have to quit doing what it is that you can't stop doing before people can help you. And that doesn't make any sense. We do have things we can do for people while they're still actively using, and we should be doing things for people. This is when they need us the most. I have never met somebody in chaotic drug use. And I need to be clear, most people that use drugs don't have problems with it. It's the people that struggle with chaotic use and addictive use. They need services that make sense. And that would be medication-assisted treatment. Those are the gold standard for people with opiate addiction. But we don't see that used near often enough.
Well, we'll talk more about that, Louise. I have to take a break right here.
Okay.
I'm going to bring you back, and I'm going to bring some others in on our discussion to talk about how widespread opioid abuse is and some of the strategies in combating the crisis now in opioid abuse. And, of course, we'll return to your story as well, Louise Vincent, here on The State of Things as we continue our conversation just ahead. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about opioid addiction in North Carolina today. I was talking with Louise Vincent, who is a recovering addict who lost her daughter in a rehab center, and we will continue our conversation with her. But now I'm going to turn to Jason DeBruin, who is WUNC's data reporter, to get a feel for this problem more generally. Jason, you know, give us a sense of what we're seeing now in terms of opioid addiction and its increase here in North Carolina and nationally, I guess.
Certainly, at least the deaths have increased dramatically since about 1999. At that point, deaths from an overdose situation were half the murder rate, only about 230 deaths from an overdose, more than 500 deaths from a murder. In 2015, that had completely reversed. Murders didn't increase hardly at all. There were about 560 murders last year, so barely an uptick, but there were more than 1,200 deaths from overdose. So you see that this is something that has just spiked dramatically
and
in the past decade.
Why an increase in deaths?
So it's partly because the drugs are stronger. You're having heroin use more commonly now, which is just a very strong drug to begin with. But then in addition to that, heroin is now being laced with fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid, and it can be as much as 50 times more potent than heroin. So people are injecting the drug thinking that they're getting, you know, quote-unquote normal heroin, if you will, but then it's just so much stronger so that the overdose then kicks in and people are dying.
All right, and in terms of the North Carolina, how do we rank compared to other states?
We're not, you know, much different than other states, to be honest. This is something that has plagued the nation. Where we are pretty advanced is in some of the treatments that we're offering. We have, for example, pretty progressive 911, Good Samaritan laws, where if people call 911 because their friend is having an overdose but they have drug paraphernalia laying around, they won't necessarily be arrested. We talked about naloxone. Naloxone is now available without a prescription to anybody who would like to get it, so they can have, you know, a kit that would reverse an overdose situation on them, so that if one of their friends is overdosing, they can resuscitate that life. So there are things that are happening, but deaths are still happening as well.
All right, well, we talked about the increase in deaths, but there's also an increase in opioid use, and we want to find out a little bit more about that. And for that, we've invited Dr. Robin Jordan on the program. She's a psychiatrist at the UNC School of Medicine. Dr. Jordan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit more. What trends do you see in terms of patients and their addictions?
Well, as far as the increase in opiate use, I think we've seen that quite a bit. I have two opiate addiction clinics in Chapel Hill. And previously, those clinics, about half the clinic was general psychiatry and half the clinic was addiction. And in the past 2 years or so, the increase in addiction, it's just become so bad that now 100% of the clinic is addiction. And we have no room for other people. So it used to be that we could always accept new patients. Now we cannot.
Any idea what's happening? Why is that?
I think there's several reasons. I mean, back in the 80s, there was this huge push for physicians to treat pain more appropriately. There was this drive that pain was not being treated adequately. Opiates were safe. They didn't see a big problem with opiate use at that time. I don't think it was appreciated, the dependence that could develop from opiate use. So physicians began prescribing a lot more to treat pain. And I think that the consequence of this now is that we see the opiate epidemic as we're facing, that patients are becoming dependent on the opiates.
Is there a link? Are we seeing the link between pills and prescription medicine and opioid addiction?
Absolutely. I think there's this false idea that heroin users are only heroin users, and these aren't people who started out with prescription pain pills, and that is absolutely not true. Large proportion of my clinic started out with a broken ankle or broken collarbone or a car accident, and were given a prescription for opiates. And that's where it starts. And then they develop dependence.
Well, that's the view from the clinic. Let's take a look at what this looks like from the street. Donnie Varnell is a longtime law enforcement officer now with the Derrick County Sheriff's Office. Donnie Varnell, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
What are you seeing in terms of trends in opioid use?
Well, the trends in opioid use, we saw a huge increase from the late 90s through the early 2000s. I think we've mentioned the year 2000, where something that we were able to gauge, of course, were the overdose deaths. And we saw that early on. And it was all prescription narcotics at that time. And we see the same thing Dr. Jordan has mentioned, that most of the heroin users that we've dealt with or heroin subjects on the street will say they started with prescription medication. And 70% of our overdoses are still prescription medication. we've just had over a 500% spike in heroin overdoses. So heroin has taken front and center in law enforcement because it has become such an explosion of a problem. And, of course, it is so much stronger. And it, as Jason said, it's being laced with fentanyl is actually something that on the street people want because it is a stronger substance. And they'll pay extra for it, but then they have no idea how strong it is, and you see the overdoses. So we have seen prescription narcotics explode as a law enforcement issue. And traditional law enforcement methods, we obviously have not stopped it. But I think by working, North Carolina has been on the forefront in working with multiple disciplinary agencies to give better prescribing practices. And we have seen the amount of prescription narcotics slow down some, which, of course, makes them harder to get. And heroin, quite frankly, is cheaper and sometimes easier to get for people that have a substance use issue.
You've been part of the change in law enforcement and how law enforcement has approached opioid use on the streets. You were part of bringing naloxone into law enforcement agencies. Tell us about that, because you had to evolve yourself in your understanding of whether or not to use naloxone.
Sure. Actually, I was just very fortunate to be around some really outstanding people that gave me a chance to help them. The North Carolina Harm Reduction that Louise is a part of, I was a part of for a while, and they showed us the naloxone program, and something, again, measurable was the overdose deaths, and if we could just lower the death rate by one so we weren't losing 1,300 people a year to overdoses, just made absolute sense to us in law enforcement. And so we bought in completely, and it was some resistance to begin with because there's liability issues, funding issues, but I think it helped our relationship that we built because I was able to also help give the message, and let's face it, I look like a cop and I talk like a cop, and sometimes it helps to listen to the message that way. And we went from zero law enforcement agencies carrying naloxone 2 years ago to over 200. As a matter of fact, we're number two in the nation in that.
Well, was there some? I mean, you talked about funding and liability, but how about some resistance on the? Because we've heard this argument about sort of moral hazard. In other words, you're encouraging people to use this if they know that they're not going to overdose, so that there's an easier way. There's a good way of protecting them against overdose.
Sure. I've heard that. I've heard that from law enforcement agencies and individuals in law enforcement agencies, but you also hear it on the street. You're going to hear it at your workplace that you're just facilitating their drug use because they know they have this safety net to overdose. And, of course, all the studies show that's absolutely false. The only person that cannot seek a better place or treatment is a person that passes away. So we've had 5,000 drug reversals in the last 2 years, and with almost zero funding. And that's kind of numbers that are hard to argue with.
Well, Louise Vincent, let me bring you back into the conversation because you heard Donnie Varnell talk about the fact that there's almost no resistance these days for law enforcement in this kind of harm reduction plan. But what are you finding in terms of treatment facilities and rehab? Is this a kind of a crusade for you? And are you finding it difficult to have this conversation with rehab facilities?
Well, resistance. I mean, harm reduction, naloxone is sort of on a conservative end of harm reduction. So naloxone is being accepted, and that's a wonderful thing. With treatment centers, there is still very much resistance. Many of them won't allow, won't even talk about overdose recognition and reversal to their clients, which I think if addiction is a chronic and relapsing illness, then you have to talk about what happens in the event of a relapse, and it's irresponsible not to. And they should provide naloxone to every person that would like it upon discharge, and certainly provide it to anyone that's being thrown out or kicked out or is leaving before they're supposed to leave. You know, it's just so important. And when we don't do it, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, let me ask Dr. Robin. I want to ask Dr. Robin Jordan a question, psychiatrist at the UNC School of Medicine. We're talking about what to do once a person is addicted, theories of law enforcement and rehabilitation. But if this is it begins with prescription drugs and perhaps the overprescription of pain medication, what's being done in terms of the medical industry to keep these to are we changing our ideas about pain and about prescribing these drugs?
Well, I excuse me. I certainly hope that we're making some changes. Excuse me.
You need some more water there?
Sorry about
we'll,
that.
We'll have that brought in.
Recovering from a cold here.
Okay.
So I hope we're making some changes. There's definitely been some changes in prescribing. We're seeing fewer physicians prescribing large amounts of opiates. Used to be that physicians would prescribe a large amount with many refills, and now we're in a position where we're able to communicate with physicians and discuss the patient's opiate addiction and what's most appropriate for the amount of opiates they should be receiving, and if they should have refills, how we manage those refills. So we're seeing large improvements in that. It's also, I think physicians are looking more to alternatives for pain treatment than just opiates. So there's a big drive in that and not using opiates for chronic pain management.
Jason,
that we used to see.
I know you've been looking into this
as
well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the medical board has also taken a lead on this. I shouldn't say they've changed their policy. They haven't. They've always been very clear that appropriate prescribing habits are definitely the what they would have everyone do. But they've now taken more proactive steps where there's a registry now where if you're an opioid prescriber, you have to list how many you are prescribing and who you're prescribing them to, and the medical board will then, if there's anybody that's sort of outside of the bell curve, if you will, the medical board could actually initiate an investigation and to see what's happening. Again, not to suggest that there's necessarily anything nefarious that's going on, but the medical board for years was typically very reactionary, and now they're being a little bit more proactive in terms of trying to cut back on the improper prescribing. So there are a number of things that are happening to suggest that things could get better. And we've touched on them here today, and that's one of them. So I think there's reason to be hopeful. And I spoke with Dr. Jordan last week, and she said that brighter days are ahead, and so I'm hopeful that she's right.
Well, other changes in law enforcement too, Donnie Farnell. You're working on a new program in North Carolina that gives law enforcement more flexibility and different ways to help users, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the program we're talking about is called LEAD, which is Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. We're the first state in the South to have such a program. The other two were in Santa Fe and Seattle to begin with. And in the past, I tell people all the time that law enforcement they have training, tools, and direction, and they do a really good job with that. But the discretion they had was limited when you came up to a person that had drug paraphernalia and small amounts of substances on them. This program, through a partnership with Harm Reduction and the Fayetteville Police Department, started there. A law enforcement officer comes across the same person, and instead of taking traditional law enforcement methods of arresting them and processing them through jail and the court system, they're able to offer them a wraparound service program. And we've discussed drug treatment all the time, and people think of rehab. But we found in the program most people need a place to stay. They don't have safe housing. They don't have a job. They have food fears that they can't feed themselves or their family. So those wraparound programs were provided for free. The LMEs, in this case Alliance Healthcare right here in the Raleigh-Durham area, has stepped up and helped provide the funding for that. And so it gives the Fayetteville Police Department in the beginning the chance to take that person, put him into a treatment program, and they're 60% less likely to be rearrested at that time.
Wow. If there had been any pushback, like, wait a minute, we're going to see these guys over and over again, lock them up, right? And if there had been that kind of pushback, you now have statistics that tell a different story.
Correct. And even at the extremes of funding on both ends, it is three times more expensive to incarcerate people through the judicial system than it is to give them full treatment programs, not just a little bit. And those statistics they're 3 and 4 years old now. So we show that is accurate. And you're right, municipalities like to see a savings. And the people in those programs also don't call 911 or go to the emergency room for treatment anymore. They have a treatment program. So it is a true cost-saving issue, but also it puts that person, as Louise was saying, into a better place because it's a harm reduction model. Into a better place for them at that point. And from there, we have seen locations like the Wilmington Police Department, Statesville, Waynesville, out near Asheville, are all coming online with programs of their own. So it's a little bit of an excitement that North Carolina may be on the cutting edge of finding a shift in the how we treat individuals.
It's very encouraging. Louise, let me ask you how harm reduction, how that approach, if it has changed your life and how.
Oh, absolutely. it's changed everything for me. And I think just in terms of, I mean, individually, it changed everything for me. It allows me room to have my own personal, individual recovery. So recovery is not just one narrative, you know, and it has to be one way. So I am able to develop and create what I need to do for me to be okay. And it's just a more loving approach, and I don't have to feel ashamed if I step backwards or for, you know, it's just so much freer. And it allows me to love people exactly where they are, and it allows me room to allow people to develop what they want to do. I mean, it is any positive change, and we should celebrate positive change in people. I mean, behavior change is one of the hardest things that people, human beings, do. It is very hard for people to change. And so when people make small steps, that's a beautiful thing. And, you know, it just makes so much of a difference to take the smaller steps and celebrate those small steps instead of having to take a huge giant leap and be a, you know, either be a complete success or a complete failure. Well, harm reduction allows you to be, you know, allows you to be human.
You know, Louise Vinson, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you.
Louise works with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. I've also been talking with WUNC data reporter Jason DeBruin, Dr. Robin Jordan, who's a psychiatrist at the UNC School of Medicine, and also Donnie Varnell, a longtime law enforcement officer who is currently with the Dare County Sheriff's Office. Thank the three of you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.